out of my life. And I hung up the phone. I slammed that receiver down. And I rode away on my bicycle, and I went and met my friends, and everything was fine. And, you know, I'm sure I told all these horrible stories about, oh, yeah, my mean mom won't let me do this, won't let me do that, won't let me have my stuff. And it was all about me. And I can't even imagine what her part of that conversation was. She had to have been alone in that home and worried about her 15-year-old daughter who was on the street. She didn't know where I was staying. She didn't know who I was with. She didn't know if I was eating. She didn't know if I had a safe place to sleep. All she knew was that her bratty daughter did not want to surrender any kind of power or pride. Her heart had to have been breaking. But she summoned up the strength to stand her ground and to let me know that I couldn't just do whatever I wanted to do. I don't know how the rest of that day went for her, but I do know that the next day I was at a girlfriend's house and somebody called the Granada Theater where I worked looking for me. I got a phone call that said, "You need to come home." I was still mad from the day before. With all of my pride and all of my indignation, and no, I don't have to do what she says. And my mom's friend on the other end of that phone says, "No, Debbie, you have to come home." And I'm thinking, no, you're just going to try and make peace. You're just going to try and get me to agree to do what she says. And I don't have to. And she said, "No, Debbie, you don't understand. It's important. You have to come home." And I remember sighing. I'm thinking, okay, fine. If it's that important, fine. So I got a friend to drive me home. And as we got close to the house, we got close to the cul-de-sac, the first thing I remember seeing was yellow tape. And I really was speechless. I remember looking at that yellow tape and going, oh man, she said it was important, but what the heck? Because everybody knows what yellow tape means. Yellow tape means somebody's dead. And I couldn't even fathom. I mean, honestly, my mind was just racing like it is right now. Just racing, going, man, what in the world could have happened for all these police and all of these news cameras and all of this yellow tape? What in the world is going on? But the car stopped. And I got out and I walked towards the house and I'm looking at the tape. The yellow tape went across the end of the cul-de-sac, all the way around our house, all the way around the front yard. My mom's car was in the driveway. She drove a 1979 Datsun 280Z, very sporty, chocolate brown with that little metallic flake in the paint. And I'm looking at this house and there's yellow tape everywhere and there's people everywhere. And there's cops walking in and out of the front door, back and forth to the vehicles that were parked in the street. And I looked around the cul-de-sac, and there were reporters and news cameras, and there were neighbors everywhere, little groups of neighbors, two or three over here and four or five over here, and everybody's talking and looking over towards our house and pointing and making gestures. And it was obvious that nobody really understood what was going on. They were all just looking at that yellow tape too. And as I stepped toward the house, I remember my mom's friend was the first one to find me. And she was saying, "Yes, this is Sherry's daughter. This is Debbie." And almost immediately, my eyes strayed over to the right a little bit and I spotted Greg's car. Greg drove this fantastic little Camaro. White Camaro with the big fat racing stripe kind of thing painted on the hood. I saw Greg's car, and for just a minute, my heart leapt. I thought, oh, good, Greg's here. If Greg's here, everything's going to be all right. I spouted out, "Where's Greg? I want to see Greg." And somebody said, "Greg who? What are you talking about? Who's Greg?" And I said, "Greg Sanchez. That's his car right there. Where is he? I want to see Greg." I very quickly got escorted across the street and around the corner to my mom's friend's house. I remember sitting down and my mom's friend was sitting next to me. And the police were all around me, and I don't know if it was one or two officers, but I remember somebody just looking me in the eye and saying, "We don't have all the details, but there are two bodies in your house, and we believe that one of them is your mother." And I thought, two bodies? Wait a minute, how is that possible? How is that even possible? And I thought, well, wait a minute. If there are two bodies in the house, what, did they have an argument and Greg killed her and then killed himself? What in the world is going on? I just remember thinking, man, this cannot be happening. And then the smart aleck teenager in me, kind of the little voice kicked in from the side and said, two bodies and they think one of them is my mother. Duh. Of course there's one of them is my mother. What? Who else could it be? And then I went back to, oh my gosh, is my mom really dead? And in all of this, I mean, as I'm sitting here thinking about it and talking about it now, I'm just blubbering. There are tears pouring. But in all of that, I don't think I blinked, and I don't think I cried. I think I was just stunned. I don't know, in my mind, there's just all of these images that just race through of my mother nurturing me and taking care of me and reading to me and singing to me and shopping with me and yelling at me and me yelling back. I'm thinking, why don't you just stay out of my life? And that's not what I meant. That was not what I meant. My knowledge of the murders has come in stages. I was never allowed to go back into the house itself. The police sat me down that very, you know, within the first few minutes that I arrived at the scene. I was in my mom's friend, her name is Marna. I was in Marna's house in her living room, and I think she was seated on that couch next to me, and police maybe pulled up a chair close in front of me to talk to me. And they asked so many questions, and really it was apparent to me that they were just grasping at straws. They ask outlandish things like, did your mom do drugs? Could somebody have broken into the house to steal drugs and killed your mom and Greg in the process? They asked me about other boyfriends, if there were, you know, other men that she had dated besides Greg that might have gotten jealous. I don't think the word rape ever came into the equation. And in later years, you know, I started to gather more information and piece together what had actually happened. But that was way, 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 way later, like 20 years later, that they had both been bludgeoned to death and that there was a gun used. Greg was shot one time. And the way I understand it, that bullet went through the cheek and back out again. So that shot incapacitated him for some time, but did not kill him. And that my mom and Greg were both beaten with some sort of heavy object. Didn't know for a very long time what kind of an object, if it was a vase or a lamp. I think it's been determined that the bludgeon had to have been some kind of a tool that came from the outside of the house. From the time that I found out that Mom and Greg had been killed, almost immediately, Marna said to me, "You need to call your dad." And so I called my dad in San Diego, and he immediately drove up to be at my side and to kind of walk me through the logistics. So my dad came to town. The police had questioned him just relentlessly. And I didn't realize it until years later. They actually took my dad into the house and into the master bedroom with all of the blood spatter, and they interrogated him for hours and hours and hours. And of course, you look at police work, that's what you do. Somebody dies, you look at the ex. After the murders, I stayed at Marna's house. My dad stayed there as well. I have been fortunate enough over the years to reconnect with Marna. She has told me that she was really uncomfortable because the police had been questioning my dad as far as his involvement in possibly the murders. And she was like, okay, the man can't afford a hotel and he's here from out of town and this is turbulent and we need to be, you know, do the Christian neighborly thing and put him up. But what if he's the killer?
Murders are more seriously and intensely investigated by law enforcement than any other type of crime. Those investigations can be distasteful and painful for family members. They are often the first people that have to be ruled out as suspects. To accelerate this process, they're offered a polygraph.
At the sheriff's office, I remember taking a lie detector test, and they asked me specifically, "Do you know who killed your mother?" And they said, "Did you have something to do with your mother's death?" I mean, it was the kind of thing that just had me shaking my head going, whoa. I mean, I remember just thinking, man, how desperate are they for answers that they're looking at me? I mean, I was just blown away. And I know they were doing a good job. I do not mean to imply that the police were inept in any way. I think they worked that crime scene. I think they worked every single lead they could possibly work. I think they turned over every stone they could find. And there was nothing to go on. Once they finished processing the crime scene, they said, okay, now you can get your things out of the home.
There are at least two reasons why law enforcement would exclude a family member from the scene of a homicide. The first is to protect the crime scene from contamination by the family member. The second is to protect the family members from the horrors that were visited upon the victims at the scene.
Finally, at some point, somebody said to me, and I'm sure it was somebody from the sheriff's office, said, "No, you don't understand, young lady. You can't go back in there. It's too messy." And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I was allowed to go in as far as the garage. Police would bring a piece of furniture or a vase or something. Man, Dad must have rented a U-Haul, and we were loading our belongings into this truck. I remember just being so frustrated that I wasn't allowed to go back inside. Over the years, I've never known what happened to Mom's purse or her wallet or her driver's license or her address book. I mean, just basic kinds of stuff. Later on in my life, I had turbulent years where I moved around a lot. I was homeless for a time period. I had a storage garage that I couldn't pay for, and so stuff got confiscated and auctioned off. So over the years, I've lost track of a lot of things that were my mom's, her pieces of her clothing and her jewelry. It has always lingered with me as an unknown chapter. I came away from Santa Barbara with this kind of unfinished aspect where I said goodbye to people. I'd be like, okay, I'm going back to Dad's house. And a lot of those connections there were severed for a very, very, very long time. People would say, you know, "Debbie, we heard about what happened. How are you doing?" And I would just say, "I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm getting through this. I'm okay."
People process trauma differently. Some live life in a perpetual fog afterwards. Others report a complete emotional shutdown. There's no question that trauma can have profound and long-lasting effects on those who suffer through it. Debbie describes her reaction this way.
My mom and Greg's deaths were my first experiences with death. I had never lost a person. I'd never been to a funeral before. And to compound that with not just death, but violent, horrific, brutal death, I just had no clue how to handle any of that. So I just chose not to. We tried one counseling session, I think, my brother and I together, and I don't remember anything about it other than that was the one and only session we ever did. So apparently it didn't go real well. And I ended up just really internalizing a lot of the trauma and the loss and the grief and moving forward with a life that did make sense. I had school and theater and church and just kind of moving forward with day-to-day life. And investigation-wise, if there was news from the sheriff's department about the crime, things that they were learning, if they had any suspects, if they had any leads, that was never communicated to me. By the end of the first year, and certainly by the time I finished high school, it was just obvious to me that the case was cold. It was never going to be solved. They were never going to figure it out. And whatever they did have was sitting in a file box on a shelf, gathering dust, and it was never, ever going to be solved. And for all of that to be packaged up into a box full of file folders and forgotten about was just so troubling. And so it just made me so sad. I started to get depression kinds of issues. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I started experimenting with drugs, and I ended up getting hooked on methamphetamine, and I lost probably close to 10 years living on welfare. I just had some really, really ugly chapters of my life. My natural optimism just kind of went by the wayside, and I kept thinking, you know what? This is life. There had been a few times in this 20-year period that I had dared to pick up a phone and call Santa Barbara Sheriff's Office and say, hey, my name's Debbie Domingo. You've probably never heard of me or my mom, but there's this unsolved murder from 1981. Is there anybody there who can update me on the case? And always with the answer of, well, yes, the case is never officially closed, but we don't have anything new. And, you know, you can only make that phone call so many times before you just think, I ain't calling anymore. I don't want to hear no news anymore. My mom. When you lose somebody, there's always the tendency to remember the good things, remember the smile and the generosity and the music and the laugh. There are so many songs that I relate to her and to Greg. I remember being with Greg at one point and hearing Baby Come Back on the radio. Baby Come Back. He said, that's my song for your mom. And I was like, okay, Greg, whatever. But during that time, they were together. So I just kind of chuckled at that. She, the Pina Colada song, where he's reading the classifieds and he's with his girlfriend, but he's reading the classifieds and thinking there may be other fish in the sea. And so he writes to this one and he's going to meet her. And it turns out to be his girlfriend. And it's like, that was pretty typical of mom and Greg. They were together. They'd break up. So the Pina Colada song is one that every time I hear it, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, Mom and Greg, they break up, but they're always going to end up back together eventually. And in some strange, ironic way, you know, they were broken up when they died, but they were killed together. So in my heart and soul, I'm like, okay, yeah, ultimately, they're together. They just are.
Chapter 7, His Last Attack. I want to remind you that our story does have descriptions of violent crimes and sexual assaults. It may not be suitable for some listeners. Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez are murdered on July 27, 1981. Their murders won't officially be connected to the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker series until 2001. But in hindsight, the details of the attack reveal volumes about the killer and may explain why 5 years go by before he attacks again.
So on July 27, 1981, Gregory Sanchez drops by Sherry Domingo's house in Goleta, California. So in this attack, it appears that the offender enters in through the south gate and notices a pile of wood stakes. He grabs that wood stake and then goes around the rear perimeter of the house to the north side of the house where the master bedroom is at. This is an unusual house in that the master bathroom has a door that leads out to the side of the house where now the offender is standing there with a wood stake. He sees this garden shed and opens that garden shed up and finds two better weapons. It appears there's a pipe wrench and a tool similar to a nail puller inside this garden shed. At this point, he breaks into the house. It appears that Gregory Sanchez hears something, gets up, possibly grabs a flashlight, and then ends up facing where the sound is, which is coming from the master bathroom. The offender comes into the room from the master bathroom and is now standing at a distance, but face to face with 6'3" Gregory Sanchez. The offender, armed with a gun, shoots Gregory Sanchez. The bullet enters Gregory Sanchez's left cheek and exits out behind his left ear. However, it's a non-fatal wound, but it most certainly would be a stunning blow, would cause Gregory Sanchez to potentially lose consciousness. Gregory Sanchez drops down onto the floor, and at this point, the offender is now able to go and go hands-on with Sherry Domingo on the bed. And he gets her hands bound behind her back, and it appears that there is, at some point during this attack, some sexual activity, because he does leave his DNA behind in this case. Gregory Sanchez becomes alert again. He reanimates, and now the offender has to go and get hands-on with Gregory Sanchez. He gets into a physical fight with this 6'3" male, a physically bigger male than what the offender is. We see blows being inflicted to Gregory Sanchez's face, like from a fist, and then Gregory Sanchez ultimately has multiple blows from a thin weapon to the back of his head. The blood staining that is present within the closet where this battle appears to have flowed into tends to suggest that Gregory Sanchez possibly laid motionless multiple times during the course of this activity, possibly with the offender leaving him and having to come back when he's noticing that Sanchez is still alive and having to inflict more blows. Ultimately, Sanchez doesn't move again. Though Gregory Sanchez put up quite a struggle with the offender, he ultimately lost. He is found laying face down with his head in the closet, and a pile of clothes had been pulled off the closet rod and dumped on top of him. Once Gregory Sanchez had been bludgeoned to death, the killer goes over, bludgeons Sherry Domingo on the bed, and then leaves the house. I believe the killer could have been hurt during this attack. He most certainly was scared, and he left that crime scene thinking, I could have been caught, I could have been killed, I don't want either to occur. When the East Area Rapist moved down to Southern California in 1979, Southern California authorities had no idea who the East Area Rapist was. All of a sudden, they had somebody who was breaking into houses in the middle of the night and typically bludgeoning his victims to death. They actually start calling him the Night Stalker. Now, today, everybody thinks of Richard Ramirez when they hear the term Night Stalker. Well, that's because the media, when they started following Richard Ramirez, called him the Night Stalker.
Richard Ramirez was a serial killer and rapist who killed at least 14 people in the Los Angeles and San Francisco areas. He was captured in 1985.
At this point, Orange County, Santa Barbara, and Ventura authorities have to come up and rename their offender. I believe it was law enforcement or the media that came up with the term original Night Stalker. Actually, it might even have been Larry Poole.
My name is Larry Poole, P-O-O-L. I just merely referred to him as the original Night Stalker, and the media, when they picked up on that name kind of stuck. I was the case agent for the original Night Stalker investigation for the Orange County Sheriff's Department from 1997 through 2013.
Typically, it's the media that likes to give serial killers a catchy name.
As crass as it may sound, some level of marketing does benefit a case. You're seeking the community's assistance. When you refer to a moniker such as that, they immediately know who you're speaking about.
For 5 years, the original Night Stalker goes quiet. No murders or rapes are reported that match his M.O. And to date, no other cases during this period have been linked to him by DNA. Some investigators think it's possible he could be responsible for other murders and rapes at the time. But until they have that evidence in hand, it's all just speculation.
Okay, so now we're going to head to Encina Drive in Irvine, where Janelle Cruz was killed in May 1986. It's about 2 miles northeast from the location where he killed Manuela Huitun in 1981. This is it, right here. That's where Janelle Cruz's house is. So now we're standing at the park that is behind Janelle Cruz's former house. Early investigators, as they were assessing the crime scene locations, thought they noticed a pattern that the offender was purposefully attacking houses that were near open spaces. They thought that he possibly was using a park like this in order to prowl and be able to gain access to the rear yards of houses.
My name is Michelle Cruz, and I'm the sister of Janelle Cruz, the last known victim of the Golden State Killer. In March 1986, I decided to go to Mammoth Mountain with a bunch of my friends and my boyfriend. My parents didn't want me to. I was a senior in high school and everybody was going. People that had already graduated from school, they were all going up to the mountain to work on the mountain because it was a really good snow season. And my boyfriend was going, so I'm like, I want to go. My mom and my stepfather were separated and they were in the process of possibly getting back together again. My stepfather was going on vacation to Cancun and he was taking my little brother. And my mom did not want him to take my little brother to Cancun without her. And so they decided that she would go as well. It was a last minute thing.
This leaves 19-year-old Janelle Cruz alone at her family's home on the night of the attack.
Janelle and I had a very close bond. We did everything together. We had the same group of friends. However, Janelle was more outgoing when it came to meeting different people. She was very charismatic, and I would say the guys just kind of flocked towards her. She only had a few close girlfriends, but Janelle and I were like best friends. We fought like sisters. We got in some pretty good fights, but if it came down to it, she would be the first one to protect me from a bully. She also protected me from our stepfather. We had an abusive stepfather. There was one time that I remember where Janelle needed to kind of step in and take the beating from our stepfather. We were just kids. We were, I don't know, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old. And, you know, we had to be home at 5 o'clock. So we rode our bikes home and we knew, gosh, we better hurry up before 5 o'clock hits or we're going to get in trouble. So we rushed and rushed and rushed. We finally got home and our stepdad was outside and he had a belt and he was pulling the belt, making a slapping noise. And we're like, oh boy, we're gonna get in trouble. And so we were about just a couple minutes past five, maybe 5:05. Janelle walked in and she got beat up for that. He pushed her around. There was another incident where I can remember a boy coming over, knocking on the door, and our stepdad opened the door, and this boy said, is Janelle there? We were in maybe fifth and sixth grade at the time. Well, the boy was a black boy, and my stepfather slammed the door and took Janelle into the other room, into his bedroom. And I can hear Janelle screaming and him throwing her up against the wall and pushing her. And I don't know what he was doing in there, but, you know, she was crying and screaming. And my mom and I sat in another bedroom just listening to it. We couldn't do anything. I don't know why my mom didn't step up. She would say because he was just very controlling. Janelle was 5'1" with an hourglass figure. She was short, but she had a really skinny waist and big hips and long brown hair, and she'd parted on the side. Didn't wear a lot of makeup, just maybe some eyeliner. And she looked very natural. And we have Puerto Rican in us, so we had a Spanish look to us. And she had light brown hair, hazel brown eyes. She was natural pretty and soft-spoken. The guys loved her. She just had a charismatic personality. There was a time where she cut her hair really short because she was tired of guys looking at her and trying to get together with her. So she cut it short so that she wouldn't be as cute to them. That didn't work. They still liked her. Janelle went on dates. She didn't really have any steady boyfriends. She just had a lot of friends. But these friends really liked her. They were in love with her, but they were just friends. She would hang out with them, go to the beach, go to their house, they'd drive her around. To her, these were just good friends, but to the guys, they probably felt like there was more than that. But she did not have a boyfriend at the time. Janelle and I actually talked about having a double wedding, so we'd get married and we'd have our kids and we'd be neighbors and we'd raise our kids together. Yeah, we thought about all those things. May 4th, 1986, my parents left for Cancun with my younger brother, and Janelle had a friend over. They had heard noises by the window. Janelle looked out and didn't see anything, and she disregarded it as maybe a cat. And so they just continued on listening to music, talking, and Janelle was showing him some poetry. At around 10:45, he said he had to leave because he had his mother's car, and so he had to take the car back to his mom and go back home. And from 11 o'clock to 12, I don't know if that was the moment she was brutally raped and murdered, but I do know that a friend called her around midnight, and she did not pick up the phone. I don't know if she had been killed just before or if she was struggling at midnight trying to stay alive. One way or the other, that's when Janelle was killed.
My name is Larry Montgomery. I worked for the Irvine Police Department. We discovered it on May 5th of 1986, late in the afternoon. The home was for sale, so there were realtors that were sometimes coming by with potential buyers to open the lockbox and go inside and take a look. And I think it was near close to 5 o'clock in the afternoon when a realtor arrived with some potential buyers. They entered the house through the lockbox in the front door, and they were the ones that actually discovered the crime when they entered Janelle Cruz's room. She was found dead on the bed, and they called the police. I went directly to the scene along with several other investigators. When we arrived at Janelle's home, we saw that there was a back sliding glass door that was opened about a foot. There was a carton of milk that was on a table near the refrigerator that was partially full of milk. Janelle was in her bedroom, which was down around a corner away from the kitchen a ways. And she was on her bed. She was on her back. She had blankets covering her face, and she had been bludgeoned fairly severely. It looked very much like she may have been tied up, and then the ties were taken, and she was left in that position. She was very bloody. When the lab people got there, they said that there were tufts of material on her, and I asked the lab, what is that? I saw it. They were able to describe that. If you take a cloth and you rip it, then the little stuff which is falls from that would be tufts of basically the threads. Gravity takes it down to wherever it stops. In this case, it was on her body. Her hands were in a position that looked like they were tied, but there was no ligature marks on it. Ropes usually make a ligature mark. However, ties, like if they are made from soft ligatures, they wouldn't make a imprint.
So at that time, Janelle and I, we shared a bedroom. We had the white shutters and a white dresser. And on the dresser, Janelle would put up, you know, a jewelry box and hang her jewelry, things like that. And then we had our closet. It was a mirrored closet that we could open, you know, back and forth.
How Janelle Cruz's body was positioned on the bed was interesting. Her head is towards the foot of the bed. In Janelle's room, her closet had those mirrored doors. I believe that as the offender is on top of Janelle and he's sexually assaulting her and then ultimately bludgeoning her, he's able to watch himself do that in that closet mirror.
Janelle's family said that there was a pipe wrench next to the back door that they remembered being there when they went on their vacation, and it wasn't there, and we never found it. That may be the weapon used by the killer. The back slider was opened. It wasn't forced open. It was opened when the people came with the realtor. So it's very possible the suspect came through that unlocked slider, took the tool with him, and used that tool to kill Janelle.
At some point that day, news reaches Michelle up at Mammoth Mountain.
I was working on the mountain, and my shift was over, and it was a major, major snowstorm. A lot of snow. I made it across the street after getting off, and I went to my dorms. And I changed, and I can remember going to this area where all the people who worked on the mountain would go and play pool. So we were all over there, and someone came and got me and said, you got a phone call. So I walked over to the phone, held it up to my ear, and said hello, and it was my friend on the other end, a good friend. And she's like, Michelle. And I said, yes. And she's like, are you sitting down? And I'm like, no. And she's like, you need to sit down. I'm like, okay. I'm like, what's going on? And she said, your sister was murdered. And I said, my sister got married. And she said, no, your sister was murdered. And from that point on, I do not remember hanging up that phone call. Things changed a lot at that moment. Pretty much my entire identity changed. I don't remember anything except for I was snowed in and I wanted to get home. And I couldn't get home because my boyfriend, his car was under the snow and the snow was just piled over the car. So I couldn't get out. We were snowed in. For 2 days, I waited to get out of there. I can remember my boyfriend shoveling it out and me trying to help. And it was just too difficult. We needed to let it melt because it was a lot of ice. I was stranded. I was stuck. And I remember sitting on the stairs of the dorms and people would walk by me. Are you okay? And I said, well, my sister just got murdered. And they were like, what? And nobody really wanted to talk to me. I guess I just didn't know what to say. So I was kind of by myself, just sitting there, just hoping to get home as soon as possible. I can remember going down the mountain and it was very icy. The roads were very dangerous. So we were going slow down, you know, through the mountain until we got out of all that cold. And then after that, it was like a very steady pace. We got home pretty quickly from Mammoth to Irvine. But it was a very quiet drive. We didn't say much.
Two suspects came to light. The first one, as I was talking to the neighbors across the street after we were dispatched out to the call, my sergeant in the investigation saw a car drive up with a young 17-year-old male who came down to where the tape was across the road and was making a U-turn. He looked extremely nervous. So the sergeant stopped him and talked to him and found he was sweating and he was shaking. He asked for his ID and found out he didn't have a real good reason for being down there and got his ID and let him go, brought it to me and said, you need to get a hold of this guy because something's fishy about this kid.
That night before her body was found, Janelle Cruz had dropped by the place where she works, a pizza place called Bullwinkle's. And I've wondered, was the killer a customer there and had seen this beautiful girl and decided, I'm going to follow her home and see if she could potentially be a victim?
Later on, they gave us information at Bullwinkle's that she was with a young guy that night, and she left around 7 o'clock with that guy. He had been there for an hour or so, kind of hanging out while she was finishing her shift and talking to her. They thought they could recognize him if they saw him again. They did see him again, actually, the next morning at a little after 10 o'clock. Janelle's shift started at 10 the next morning, and he came in a little after 10 that morning and asked if Janelle was there. And they said, no, she didn't come to work. And he left. So we found pictures of this kid and showed it to the people at the store. And they said, yeah, that's the kid that left with her the night before. So he became a great interest to us. We contacted him and he said that, yeah, he was there that day with Janelle at the pizza parlor. And yeah, they walked out about the same time, but they didn't leave together. And then he went home and he knew her. And when we confronted him about coming the next day, he did admit that he came in to look for her, but she wasn't there. And he said, I never went to her house ever. He doesn't know where she lived. So that seemed a little odd. We did surveillances on him. We gave him information that maybe the weapon was found because we thought if he had done this crime, that he may have taken the weapon with him and may have ditched it in a creek nearby. We could watch him and see if he goes to a creek and pulls the weapon out or something. He did not go anywhere to look for anything like that, but he went to an attorney. He came in with his attorney a day or so later, and he admitted to us something he hadn't admitted originally. He said that he lied to us before. He had left with Janelle, and he did go to her house, and he knew where she lived, and he went into her house the night before she was found dead. And they were together in her bedroom, and they listened to some music. And at one point, at 11 o'clock at night, they heard some noise that was coming from the side yard. She even went to the window and looked and didn't see anything. He just remembers they thought maybe it's a cat or something. And then he said, shortly after that, I left. He said, I lied to you because I was scared. He did admit to going back the next day and looking for her at Bullwinkle's restaurant. If he killed her, why would he go to work and ask if she's there? If he killed her, why does he have to drive by in his car and look like he's death warmed over and shaking in his boots in front of a police sergeant? And so he was off our radar because of his actions. They were not consistent with a guilty person, consistent with a lying person, but not a guilty person. But months after that is when we got our second lead that was even more powerful.
Even at that time, I thought, it's still got to be someone she knew. I always thought it has to be somebody she knew, somebody, maybe even it was just an acquaintance.
And that happened when a young man called us to say that a friend of his, Greg, had told this informant that he had killed Janelle.
When Janelle was 15 or 16, she was rebelling a little bit. You know, our stepfather was not good to us, and she started cutting herself and drinking and just doing things that weren't good. And she had reached out to my mom and asked my mom to get her some help. So my mom let her go to a hospital. And when she was in that hospital, she met Greg Gonzalez. And eventually she got out of the hospital, but she stayed in contact with Greg Gonzalez. And he was sort of a guy we all knew. Some of his friends were our friends also, and his cousins, we knew his cousins. And Greg was in a van with some of my friends after Janelle was killed and said that he had killed Janelle.
Obviously, we were very interested in, okay, who is this guy? And he tells this informant that he killed her. And he also made a statement that he had tried a similar thing, kind of like a prelude to it, to another girl he knew a couple days earlier in Santa Ana. So we discover that this guy had in fact been arrested by Santa Ana Police Department a couple days earlier. And so we get the reports regarding that arrest. And it was involving a girl that also knew this guy named Greg from rehab. She invited him into her apartment in Santa Ana a couple days before Janelle was killed. And during the time they were in the room together, there was a point where he kind of changed his attitude. Greg went over to her kitchen and got a dish towel, and he started to rip strips off the dish towel and acting really strange. And she got really scared, and she ended up actually going to a window she's on the second floor and jumping out of a window, which would be kind of dangerous, but she thought he was going to tie her up or something. And she jumped out and screamed, and the police are called, and he's caught at the scene and he's arrested, and he spent a night in jail before he was released on bail. And 2 days later, we're looking at our crime scene with a girl who's bludgeoned to death, and she's got tufts of material on her from something that would happen if you ripped some material in order to make strips to tie you up. We ended up getting him in custody. He wouldn't talk to us or did not admit to anything. We had him in custody for months. We don't have something that says he did this, guaranteed by physical evidence. We couldn't find his hair there. We couldn't find anything on his clothing that matched any blood. Didn't find any evidence from the crime scene or on his clothes or on his bicycle that he would have had to have probably ridden over. So he was released from custody, because if we went to trial, he probably would be found not guilty just because you couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right after Janelle was killed, we were living in a hotel because we didn't go back home. We never went back in that house. We moved back east, and maybe a month later, 2 months later, I had just turned 18, and I told my mom I wanted to move back to California. So I moved back to California on my own. My mom and my little brother stayed in New Jersey. The realtor, the broker who had our house listed, he gave me a job as a receptionist. I rented a room and paid my car payment and just did my own thing. And then the house sold. My mom said, "Well, you just go in there and make sure everything's out of the house for, you know, the new owner." And I can remember going over to the house and having to walk in, and it was really dark and it was really cold, and it was just a really eerie feeling. It was the strangest feeling I had ever felt. Really just wanted to get in there and get out of there as quick as possible. But I walked through the house quickly. I looked in my room and everything was clean. I didn't see any evidence of Janelle being killed in there. I never got any of my things out of my room. They were just gone. Everything was completely gone. I had the clothes in my bag, and that was it. There was one time that I drove to the house, and I saw the mattress laying outside and the box spring on our grass. And I just couldn't believe my eyes because it was just filled with blood from the top of the mattress, and it had sunk through all the way down to the bottom, to the box spring. And it was a lot of blood, and I couldn't believe that that mattress was put on our grass and nobody was there at that moment to take it away. I just happened to have driven by that house at that time and saw it there.
Janelle Cruz is the last known victim of the Golden State Killer. As the years and decades go by, the same question keeps nagging at us. Why did he stop?
So after Janelle Cruz is killed in 1986, that's the last attack that we know this offender has done. Gotta wonder, why does he stop at this point? He's been offending since 1976 for 10 years. He's getting older. It's possible he's realizing his physical skills are diminishing. When I take a look at other offenders, the one that stands out to me as being the most similar to the Golden State Killer is BTK, Dennis Rader. And when Dennis Rader was caught and when he was interviewed, he talked about in his last attack, he got into a physical fight with a male that he was not expecting to be present inside that house. And even though he won that battle, he left that house scared. And I think the same type of thing possibly is happening with the Golden State Killer.
Sometimes serial killers stop because they're getting older or because they've gone through a major change in their lives, such as getting married or having kids. But in this case, it could also be out of fear of DNA science.
I've also looked at whether or not he was concerned about the evidence he'd left behind.
This was in 1986. I think that was the year actually when people started talking about the possibility of DNA.
In the late 1980s, DNA starts coming into the headlines in criminal cases. However, the public really didn't become aware of DNA technology until the O.J. Simpson case in 1995. And that's when the public is learning all about DNA testing and what it means. The Golden State Killer has to be watching the O.J. trial, and he's thinking, uh-oh, I've left my DNA everywhere. Even though he did everything else he possibly could, he hid his face. He prevented leaving fingerprints behind. He disguised his voice. He did all that verbal staging. He's now recognizing that this DNA technology could catch him.
Chapter 8, Primary Suspects. In 2001, when Paul uses DNA to prove the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker are the same criminal, he ships all of his evidence down to Detective Larry Poole in Orange County. The Orange County Sheriff's Department hosts a press conference to announce that these two unsolved crime sprees are connected. Now this feels like a solvable case. Plus, there's no statute of limitations on murder, so the 10 homicide cases in Southern California are prosecutable, as long as the killer's still alive. But is he? Since 1986, he's been silent. Then, days after the press conference, the 14th victim of the East Area Rapist gets a phone call. On the other end of the line, she hears the same voice she heard 24 years earlier. He says, "Remember when we played?" Law enforcement is convinced the call came from the East Area Rapist.
That showed me, this is a guy that can stay quiet for a long stretch of time. And that's why I kept saying, it's very possible he's still alive. And people are saying, no, he would have continued to attack, or he would have made phone calls or done. I was like, no, you look at that, for 15 years, we have nothing. From 1986 to 2001, he can be quiet. He's kind of following what's going on. He may be fantasizing about committing more cases. Maybe he has some attacks we don't know about yet, but he's somebody that can lay low for a long period of time. So after 2001, he's laying low, and his estimated age range of when he was attacking put him to where he most certainly could still be alive.
In 2001, Michelle Cruz, the sister of Janelle Cruz, the last known victim, also receives phone calls.
The Orange County Sheriff's Department held a press conference where I showed up, and a lot of news stations were there. I asked them to only put my maiden name on there, Michelle Cruz, but they had put my married name. And after that press conference, I went home, and the next day, I went to work, and I picked up my two children at the time, and came home, and I started getting phone calls. So I'd pick up the phone, and I'd say hello. And they wouldn't answer, but they remained on the line, and I could hear them breathing. And I would hang up. And immediately later, right after I'd hang up, they would call me back. And again, I'd say, hello. And they wouldn't say anything, but they would stay on the phone. And I would hang up. And then they would do it again. And they probably did it 8 times every evening for about a week, just like that. They would call, stay on the phone, listen to my voice. And the very last time that they called, I was so freaked out by it. I said, stop calling me. This phone has been tapped. And I immediately called the police department and I did a police report on it. And he stopped calling. I was a single parent. And so I was living there with my 2 kids and just really scary.
With the Northern and Southern California cases officially connected and the killer apparently still alive, these cold cases are now hot once again. They're now referred to by the unwieldy initials EARONS, or called EARONS. Paul feels he's taken the case as far as he can. He hands it off to Larry Poole in Orange County and moves on.
Larry and I continued to communicate as his staff were going through the information that I had provided him. But I really just pushed away and was in a support role, thinking this is Larry's thing. He's got homicide cases in Southern California. He needs to run with this. The frequency of communication with him started to slow, and then eventually it just subsided. This was Southern California's gig at that point, and just let them run with it.
In 2004, Paul begins working a homicide case with a veteran cop, Ray Giacomelli, from the industrial coastal town of Pittsburgh in Contra Costa County.
Ray Giacomelli had come into my office and was consulting with me on this homicide case. I looked at the crime scene photos. I told him my thoughts, shook his hand, and watched him walk out of the lab. Little did I know that'd be the last time I saw Ray alive. He ended up going to that crime scene location. He was the first one to show up there. And as he walked into that house, he was ambushed and killed by Earl Foster Jr.
40-year-old Earl Foster Jr. fatally shoots Detective Giacomelli and flees in a car. 4 days later, police track him to a shopping center in Modesto, 60 miles to the west, and kill him in a gunfight. Giacomelli leaves behind a wife and 2 children.
During that moment in time, the world kind of stopped. I ended up getting heavily involved in the aftermath of Ray's homicide. And it just so happened to coincide when Lacey Peterson and Connor Peterson washed up in Contra Costa County. And I was having to coordinate dealing with their bodies at the morgue at the same time of dealing with Ray's body and the investigation into his homicide. Those are the types of situations when people say, well, how come you weren't working on the East Area Rapist all these years just continuously? It's because real life happens and other cases happen and those take you away. My career continued to progress. And at a certain point, I am, in essence, asked to promote up to the chief's position, in which I would now be overseeing the entire Forensic Services Division. And it's a job that I knew I really didn't want. Ultimately, I was convinced to take the position. However, one of the things that I always did when I moved around is I kept the East Area Rapist files with me. They did not stay in that dusty file cabinet. I wanted to make sure nothing would happen to them. So now I'm working as the ultimate administrator, overseeing an accredited crime lab, and pretty much bored out of my skull. It's not what I wanted to do. So I'm sitting in my office. It's a very nice office at this point. I've got simulated cherry desk and shelving and all sorts of file cabinets. And I had a little bit of a view out of the window on the second floor of this newer crime lab building that we had now. I'm looking at my email inbox at the various tasks that my commander is asking for me to perform. And none of it was very stimulating. And I'm sitting there basically drumming my fingers on my desk, and I'm looking at my file cabinet, and I focus in on the bottom drawer where I had all the East Area Rapist stuff that Larry Poole had returned to me. Life takes funny turns. This is now 2011, and I'm going, that case is still unsolved.
On my computer is a camera for the Sheriff's Avistar system. It was sort of the precursor to the modern Skype. And I'm wondering, is my commander going to know if I start digging back into the East Air rapist case? I was a little bit concerned that maybe he's spying on me. But I look at the camera and I'm going, nah, he can't see me. So I open up that file cabinet and I start pulling out those old files labeled with the red EAR. I said, okay, there's really two items of evidence in this series that I potentially could pursue. One was the DNA, but we had exhausted everything on the DNA side. In 2001, that DNA profile that linked the East Area Rapist and original Night Stalker had been uploaded into CODIS, the FBI's DNA database, and had been searching at the national level for a decade without hitting on anybody. In California, we were now legally able to do a familial search against the California database looking for a close paternal relative of the East Area Rapist. That had been done every single year, this familial search by California DOJ, and hadn't hit. We had done multiple international searches looking for, is our guy, did he flee the country? And is he in a DNA database over in England or over in Germany, across the globe? And we hadn't gotten a hit. And so at that point, I was recognizing, well, I've done everything possible with DNA. We've done everything possible with DNA. So what else is potentially unique enough for me to be able to try to use it to call out the East Area Rapist from the thousands of suspects that we had in our master name list? I decide, I'm going to investigate this. I'm no longer just going to be handling the forensics. I'm going to be boots on the ground and try to get this thing solved. I had done that on some of these other cold cases, and so I had developed a fair amount of experience now in investigative capacity. I felt, okay, I can take this on. And I started going through each case and really paying attention to who this offender was and developing an investigative strategy to see if I could solve it. Since that point in time, I never let the case go again. I pretty much worked on the East Area Rapist case 24/7, 365, starting in 2011, up until the time that ultimately the case was solved. The original Contra Costa County Task Force had compiled sheets on every single suspect that they evaluated, close to 1,000 different suspects. So I ended up pulling those sheets out to see which ones were rising to the level of doing more work on, why they were contacted, what was suspicious about them, were they eliminated back in the day, was that elimination valid, did they match the physical specs of what we understood that the East Area Rapist possessed. We knew, we were highly confident the guy was somewhere in the vicinity of 5'8 to 5'10 or 160 to 180 pounds, a white male. How many of these suspects were falling within those specs? So I ended up narrowing down and focusing in on a smaller group. But as I'm doing that, one suspect was starting to stand out above the rest. I'm just going to refer to the suspect as JW. It was a brakeman for the Western Pacific Railroad and one of the original Contra Costa County Task Force investigators was absolutely convinced JW was the East Area Rapist. I had spoken to Larry Crompton about JW, and Larry remembers him and said he was a good suspect, but we eliminate him based on what's called his secretor status. Well, back in the day, they had determined that the East Area Rapist was a non-secretor. So people were being eliminated based on that, and this JW railroad worker had been eliminated. They should not have relied on that because the testing could lead to a false negative, meaning you could eliminate the person as possibly being the East Area Rapist falsely. I thought, oh, there's a problem here. So this JW, turns out, he probably was never appropriately eliminated. And so I started to look at this railroad suspect very closely. He was initially contacted
in February of 1979 by Sheriff's Patrol, sleeping in his car in Danville. The night before, the deputy had chased a prowler in a neighborhood, but that prowler had escaped. And now this same deputy is finding this guy sleeping in his car. He contacts JW. JW gets out of the car, saying, "I'm commuting down from Sacramento to Milpitas, where he's working for the railroad, and decided to pull off the freeway and get some sleep after he finished his shift." Well, the deputy was saying, "Well, this location on Camino Tasajara is more than a mile and a half away from the freeway. He didn't just pull off the freeway." Additionally, because that deputy had just chased the prowler, he thought that this guy could be out there prowling and was casing the neighborhood and was just pretending to be asleep when he saw the patrol car get close. So he started to question JW a little bit more, and then he had another deputy arrive as backup. This other deputy pulls out a Polaroid camera to take JW's photograph, and when JW sees that, he starts to fight. He doesn't want his photograph to be taken. They have to fight with him and literally hold his head still in order to be able to get a Polaroid mugshot of JW. They see that JW has a warrant out for a minor violation, and they go ahead and arrest him and transport him to the jail. Once JW is booked in the jail, his mom travels from Sacramento to pick him up and bail him out the next morning. JW is up in Sacramento during the entirety of the East Area Rapist attacks in Sacramento. And when the East Area Rapist moves into Stockton and ultimately down to Modesto, JW's work with the Western Pacific Railroad was putting him in Stockton and Modesto at the same times. And when JW ends up having to transfer to the East Bay for Western Pacific Railroad, the dates were lining up out in the East Bay. So JW is showing up in the right locations at the right time. Basically, JW is the East Area Rapist's shadow if he's not the East Area Rapist. I decided